Hi, I'm Marco Werman. You're a fan of the world, so you already know that we've been tracking the coronavirus story since the beginning. Along the way, we have tapped a network of doctors, epidemiologists, and public policy experts to give you the context, latest news, and practical information you need during a pandemic. Our reporting on the coronavirus is free to listeners and readers. Our coverage has never been behind a paywall, ever. But let's face it, this kind of critical reporting is expensive to produce, which is why we're asking for your support today. Together, we can make sure nonprofit journalism is available to everyone. Please go to theworld.org/give and contribute, or follow the link right here in the episode notes. That's theworld.org/give. And thanks. For the next 3 weeks, 1.3 billion people in India can't leave their homes. Drastic times call for drastic measures.
This particular emergency, I think, has caught us unawares.
And in Spain, empty hotels are being converted into makeshift hospitals.
We have 99 rooms. We don't know really how many patients they're going to have here.
Then there's the other non-life-threatening global problem, how to deal with the boredom of life when you're stuck at home.
We're turning on our Christmas lights.
By listening to classic French songs.
The other day I bought some watercolor painting. I always wanted to try it but never did.
I'm Marco Werman. Also stacking your pantry to get you through these tough times, we peek inside kitchen cabinets across the globe. Quinoa, anyone? The stories today on The World. $1.3 billion Indians woke up today to a very different reality. They can't go outside. India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi issued a total ban on leaving homes. Modi gave the dramatic order in a speech to the nation just hours before it took effect. Modi said that these actions will determine how much India can minimize the impact of this disaster. Officially, India only has about 550 cases of the coronavirus. As the country now settles into lockdown, a looming question is whether its healthcare system will be prepared for what's next. Keshav Desiraju is former Secretary of Health and Family Welfare to the government of India. He's in Chennai.
Our public health systems usually respond well in emergencies, surprisingly well, especially when compared to normal times. But this particular emergency, I think, has caught us unawares.
China, just next door, reported its first case back in December. Did the Indian government wait too long to make this move to lock down the entire country? And was it made even more draconian because of this wait?
Enough testing was not done in time because, as you said, reports came out of China in December. But even by the end of January, there was enough information available. You know, the first flights out of China, it was reported in the Indian press that, you know, Indians in China were coming back. But at that stage, testing was not done or not done on a much larger scale. It was just people who showed several of the sort of symptomatic features were identified for testing. Whereas, if you ask me, pretty much everyone who was coming in off an international flight should have been, you know, in some manner, you know, if not fully tested, you know, checked out.
One crucial problem for countries facing the coronavirus pandemic right now is hospital capacity. Does India have enough hospital beds to deal with the number of patients who may be infected?
Well, if a tough decision is taken to take over beds in private hospitals, we would have substantially more than we do now. There are huge private hospitals, and as of now, I haven't heard that, you know, they have been requisitioned by government, which government can do using existing legal provisions. But I think that decision will need to be made, because if we didn't do this, a very large number of poor people would simply not have access to treatment.
Yeah, and that, I know, is a big concern for poor people in India. So, I mean, where are they going to be, say, a month from now?
Well, it's a very good question. You know, the other important aspect here is that there is a huge informal sector. You know, people who work for daily wages, and, you know, what they eat tonight depends on what they've earned during the day. Now, across India's cities and towns, people like this have been thrown out of work. Now, are they continuing to live in the cities? Are they going back to their homes in the villages? where, as we know, treatment is not as good as it is in the cities, at least. These are questions to which I myself don't have clear answers right now. People who are being laid off from work, the government has given instructions that people should be paid, even if they are being laid off work. But I don't know if this is happening, because there is a lot of movement back to the villages that is being reported. So it's a bit of a mess.
What keeps you awake at night right now?
Completely independent of this discussion on the pandemic. You know, for years, people have been saying that India has not been investing enough in the health sector. Alma Ata in 1978 asked for 3% of the GDP, which, of course, we have not reached. We are somewhere near 1.1, even in the current financial year. So everyone knows that we have not invested enough in strengthening public structures, which is why there is this very strong feeling that at a time of crisis, though Indians have a capacity to cope and Indians have a capacity to rally around in some manner, it's going to be very hard. It's hard enough for people who are at homes under lockdown. It's much more difficult for doctors and nurses who are at the front line.
Keshav Desiraju is a former Secretary of Health and Family Welfare to the Government of India. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, sir.
The spread of disease has no borders, and U.S. and Mexican authorities are working together to try and slow the global march of the coronavirus. San Diego's mayor, Kevin Faulkner, says his Mexican neighbors just to the south in Baja California are following San Diego's lead and closing down bars and theaters.
I can't emphasize the importance enough of this decision. It is something that we have been working on collaboratively to ensure that we move towards that model of one set of precautions, both in San Diego and on the other side of the border.
Across the entire length of the border, the U.S. and Mexico agreed to halt all crossings for non-essential purposes. That means Mexican fruits and vegetables are still landing in American grocery stores, but local commerce in border towns has come to a full stop. The World's Jorge Valencia has our story.
The border from San Diego, California to Brownsville, Texas is lined with small towns and small business owners like Ida Ann Pedregal. She runs Illusions Boutique in Douglas, Arizona.
I sell wedding, bridal, quinceañera, and prom dresses.
It's a family business. Pedregal's mother opened it about 30 years ago.
And I've had it now for about 20 years.
Pedregal's clientele is made up almost entirely of Mexican shoppers who cross the border just to go to her store. And Pedregal says sales were picking up like they usually do in the spring until last week.
And it was in the atmosphere. People started to run scared. All you could hear is, do you think it's really going to be this bad? Do you think they're, you know?
And as we know, the new coronavirus pandemic has rattled the global economy. Along the U.S.-Mexico border, the economic shock has been felt especially hard since the two governments decided on Friday to turn away people crossing for non-essential purposes.
Just from the U.S. perspective, these border crossings are absolutely essential for these what are still frontier communities.
Eric Lee is with the North American Research Partnership, a think tank, and he studies the border economy. He estimates sales taxes collected in the U.S. from Mexican shoppers represent at least 40% of local government revenues on the U.S. side of the border.
These are the day trippers who cross to see family and friends and also to pick up something at Walmart, AutoZone, Costco.
That's critical in communities like Douglas, Arizona, where, according to Lee, Mexican visitors spend as much as $95 million per year. The new travel restrictions allow for medical or academic purposes, but block travel for sightseeing or recreation. Lee says these measures are even more dramatic than the ones put in place after the 9/11 attacks.
For me, that just tells you how unusual and how serious this is.
Across the Arizona border and the state of Sonora, Governor Claudia Pavlovich has been emphatic in addresses to the public.
Este es un domingo de estar en casa.
This Sunday is for staying at home, she says in a video uploaded this weekend.
Por favor, les reitero, si no tienes ninguna actividad, subrayo, urgente.
Let me reiterate and underscore, she says. Unless it is urgent, do not leave your home. Governors and mayors across Mexico are urging people to take preventative measures, countering messaging from President Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who has encouraged people to keep going out. The number of confirmed cases continues to rise, and many are staying in, like Oscar Montalvo in the border city of Tijuana.
Tuve necesidad Mas no intenté precisamente porque...
Montalvo says he has needed to cross the border for shopping, but hasn't because of government orders and because he doesn't want to get sick. That is the same concern for retail business owners like Ida Ann Pedregop, who owns the Party Dress Boutique in Douglas, Arizona.
Right now, the most important thing is the health of the community, the well-being of the community.
Pedregop says she closed her store and had to tell her only employee that there would be no more work.
She pretty much knew. I mean, you know, I wasn't like I'm the only one. You know, what can she do when the store's closed?
Pedregó says that if she looks back at the crisis after the 9/11 attacks and the recession of 2008, it helps her remain optimistic.
Personally, I believe we will overcome this too. We just have to have faith. And I believe that as a community and as a country, we will overcome this too.
She says that whenever border activity returns to normal and local schools open their doors again, so will she. For The World, I'm Jorge Valencia.
We're all in this together, right? Well, it depends. When Italy first turned to its European neighbors for help to fight the coronavirus, not one of them responded. It leaves the question of whether the European Union can unite in the fight against the pandemic. The World's Orla Barry in London tells me each country in Europe is handling this its own way.
It varies really from one country to the next, to be honest. In terms of coordination, there's frankly been very little coordination between EU countries on this. But if you look at countries like Belgium and the Netherlands, next door neighbours to each other, on March 12th, Belgium closed all their cafes and restaurants and schools. The Netherlands, though, remained open. So Belgians just crossed the border into the Netherlands and went and had their beers there. And as a result, a few weeks later, the Netherlands then started closing its cafes and restaurants and said, well, we had to do it because the Belgians were coming over causing all of these problems. So you can see that even those countries that are very close to each other were not adopting the same kind of policies.
So what power does the EU have in a moment like this when that unity should really matter?
In many ways, it's very limited. And the reason for this is that when it comes to health, member states oversee their own health policies. As a result, the EU has found it doesn't have the kind of power perhaps that it would like to have. Where the EU will be expected to come into its own is in terms of financial support. And we can expect lots and lots of disagreements in that area as the recessions start kicking in various countries.
As I said earlier, there were no EU countries that stepped forward initially when Italy asked for help. How did Italians see that?
They certainly saw it as a sign of rejection, I think. People like Matteo Salvini, the former interior minister, saying that they felt abandoned by the EU at the time. But I talked to an Italian MEP, Irene Tignale, a little earlier about this, and I asked her if she thought Italy felt abandoned by Europe.
The first few days, of course, were difficult for everybody trying to understand how the virus was moving. So I don't think it was a problem of being insensitive. It was simply a problem of not understanding fully what was going on.
As you can see from Irene Tignale there, she's giving a more optimistic perspective on it. Certainly in the first couple of weeks, that wasn't the soundings that we were getting on the ground from Italians themselves.
So you mentioned Matteo Salvini. We've heard in the last few weeks from populist politicians like Salvini blaming migrants for the pandemic. Are there signs the coronavirus might raise nationalism in Europe?
You would expect perhaps that that could be the case. But in fact, support for Salvini's League Party actually dropped in the first few weeks of the crisis. It seems that people are turning more, in fact, towards governments themselves for direction. And I asked Susie Dennison about this today. She's with the European Council on Foreign Relations.
People are so fearful that they're actually quite welcoming of clear directive government, and that plays against the strong opposition role. Citizens want to allow clear evidence-based decisions being made.
So Orla, it's early days perhaps, but what's the likelihood that the EU will be damaged by any of this?
I think you're right. I think it is too early to tell in many ways. I spoke to Pepijn Berkson. He's with the Europe programme at Chatham House, and he essentially said no one should be writing off the EU at this time.
It's always dangerous to prophesize the end of the EU because there's a lot of political capital in Europe, in basically all the member states invested in the project succeeding. The EU is not necessarily the solution to this crisis, but it also is not threatened by this crisis.
I got to say, it's really interesting that this is the crisis the EU is now facing when 2 months ago it was Brexit.
Absolutely, Marco.
The World's Orla Barry in London. Thanks for your reporting on this.
Thanks, Marco.
Everybody has questions about the coronavirus outbreak, so we've started a weekly conversation on Facebook Live, taking your questions to health experts. Join us for our next Facebook Live tomorrow at 11 a.m. Eastern with Ashish Jha, director of Harvard's Global Health Institute. That's tomorrow, Thursday, at 11 a.m. Eastern on our Facebook page and at theworld.org. Head to our Facebook page today to add your questions. You're listening to The World. Hey there, public media fans. We know you value what we do here at The World, but it costs a lot of money to bring you these important stories, needed context, and critical voices from the front lines in our interconnected world. These days, more than ever, independent, fact-based journalism provides the information you need to get through your day and plan for the future. We're asking you now to help support it. Go to theworld.org/give. Become a monthly supporter of the program that informs, educates, and connects you with our changing world. That's theworld.org/give. Thank you. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Spain now has the second most confirmed deaths from the coronavirus, more than 3,400 people. Only Italy has reported more. In Madrid, many hospitals are at a breaking point. Even in this desperate situation, though, Spain is coming up with some creative solutions to revamp its healthcare system and keep the virus from spreading further. Jennifer Omani has more from the Spanish capital.
In Madrid, where lives are usually lived at maximum volume on street-side terraces and neighborhood bars, all you can hear now is birdsong. Spaniards are not allowed to venture outside for anything other than food or medicine, not even to exercise. The only interruption to the quiet comes from police and ambulances. Prime Minister Pedro Sánchez announced drastic measures which will stay in effect until April 12th.
Recursos económicos, recursos sanitarios.
Sánchez said the public and private sector are being recruited to help Spain's escalating battle with COVID-19. That means private hospitals are now under the control of local governments. The central government deems this necessary because Spain's public facilities have been overwhelmed. In addition, more than 5,400 health workers have contracted the virus, with many complaining they lack protective equipment. As emergency rooms at public hospitals across the country filled with patients needing immediate care, there was an outcry over private hospitals sitting half empty and refusing to admit coronavirus cases. Juan Oliva is an economist who specializes in healthcare systems.
The public system is under a lot of pressure, close to buckling almost. The health authorities and private centers have been looking for ways of collaborating, and both sides were willing to do this.
Oliva says a temporary partnership wasn't a problem because this idea was already written into public health legislation.
In Spain, it's completely normal for public hospitals to contract out certain services to private centers.
Often, this is done because Spaniards want to avoid long waits for treatment.
Private hospitals have not been nationalized. The government did not confiscate anything or force them to collaborate in offering treatment to people. They asked them to collaborate, and the private hospitals agreed.
The public-private partnership is just a band-aid, though. Coronavirus figures in Madrid are stark. More than a third of Spain's total cases have been registered here, and over half of the deaths. Around 1,000 people are in intensive care in Madrid, with most reliant on ventilators that are in short supply. Elsewhere in the capital, a massive conference centre has been requisitioned and turned into a field hospital with more than 5,000 beds. Milder cases are being sent to hotels turned makeshift hospitals. Tourism represents 12% of Spain's GDP, but with the travellers gone from Las Provincias Hotel, the lobby no longer has suitcases. It's packed with oxygen tanks. I wasn't allowed inside, but I spoke to hotel manager Carlos Martín in front of the building as he waited for the first patient to arrive.
We have 99 rooms. We don't know really how many patients they're going to have here. And we only know that it's going to be about 50 people working here from the hospital.
Carlos had already sent some staff home ahead of the ambulance's arrival, and the only thing left to do was hand over the keys.
We're trying to help them as much as we can.
The other key to Spain's strategy, stay inside. Although most Spaniards are trying their hardest not to go out unless strictly necessary, makeshift checkpoints have been set up all over Madrid. Police have issued more than 30,000 fines nationwide. Some feel the police are taking things too far. Fran Panadero was fined for riding his bike to a bakery when the closest one to him was sold out of bread. The police stopped him 50 feet from his apartment.
After having bought some bread, the police appeared. They didn't like the fact that I was out buying bread in a place that was not right next to my house. I had to go a little bit further, I know. Well, they didn't like that. Right from the first moment, the attitude of the police was that they were going to fine me.
He doesn't know how much his fine will be, but this type of infraction can cost anywhere from a few hundred euros up to 30,000 euros, or $32,000. And Panadero hasn't worked for a month and a half.
I've been just surviving since the last economic crisis, a decade of survival, and I was trying to launch a business, a leather workshop where we make bags.
At least he can laugh at the irony of getting a ticket while going to get bread.
Panadero.
His last name, Panadero, translates as baker.
Francisco Panadero.
While Panadero tries to keep his sense of humor, I should also say that it isn't quiet all the time in Madrid under lockdown. At 8 p.m. every night, everyone stands on their balconies and applauds the health workers risking their lives to stop the virus progressing. This is still Spain, after all. For The World, Jennifer Omani in Madrid.
Now we're going to hear from you. A lot of you tune in when you're in your cars, but now maybe you can't leave the house. You're in lockdown. Bored yet? Last week, we asked you to tell us what you're doing. Maybe you'll inspire others who've also gotten stay-at-home orders. Anything to change the perspective of your four walls or that screen you're sitting in front of. Here's what some of you told us.
Hi, Marco. This is Gay Reavy in Dallas, Texas, and we're all suffering boredom together, so we've decided to cheer each other up. We're turning on our Christmas lights. Some of us have to reinstall the lights. That means going up to the attic, getting the lights, putting them back up. But some of us, including me, never got around to taking our lights down. So we're in luck. We just have to plug those suckers back in.
I'm Yashu. I live in Shanghai. Advice or tips for surviving quarantine? Try some new things. Like I tried a few new recipes, and the other day I bought some watercolor painting. I always wanted to try it but never did. So use this as an opportunity to try new things.
This is Dr. Elliot Gann in Oakland, California, also known as Philip Drummond Filthy Beats. I'm director of a nonprofit that teaches kids beat making as a mental health and educational intervention, and has done beat making battles and beat ciphers where we share our hip hop beats around the globe. And now, since Sunday, I've been taking it online, share music and do what beat makers do, which is be hermits and hang out in their beat caves anyway, and play beats. So that's what I'm doing out here, based in Oakland, California, but around the world.
My name is Zainab and I live in Iran. To pass the time, I am trying to learn knitting and crochet, and I'm doing this through online tutorials. It keeps my mind and hands busy.
Bonjour, the world. My name's Paige Donner, and I'm sending this to you from Paris, France. The way I'm enjoying these days of self-isolation by listening to classic French songs like Brassens and Brel, and of course Edith Piaf.
Merci beaucoup, et je vous souhaite à tous bonne santé.
Non, rien de rien. Non, je ne regrette rien. Ni le bien qu'on m'a fait, ni le mal, tout ça m'est bien égal.
How can you possibly be bored now? News headlines are coming right up. This is The World. Billions of people stuck, sheltering in place. It can be boring and lonely, but it does give us extra time to cook.
You know, you can't control the virus. But what you can do something about is your shopping. You have full control over that.
And what happens if the coronavirus outbreak has a second act? That's all still to come here on The World. It is unprecedented in human history, the number of people around the globe now on lockdown. One of the only reasons we're allowed to leave our homes, to get food. But the planet is not buying all the same things, so we thought we'd take a global look at how people are stocking their pantries these days and how they cope when they can't find what they want. Here's The World's Bianca Hillier.
Grocery shopping is a part of my week that I look forward to. Until now.
Worried customers have been snapping up everything in sight.
Tensions flared at Woolworths when three women became involved in a toilet paper tussle.
The move has prompted panic buying of basic necessities.
That's the recent panic buying. That's
panic buying.
By the panic buying phenomenon.
Preparing for a quarantine amid the coronavirus pandemic has people panic buying food. At my grocery store in Boston, they were out of peanut butter. But people in different countries are stocking up on different foods. Though one item does seem to be pretty common.
Pasta is totally sold out.
Pasta is my go-to.
There's less pasta than normal.
Pasta. In Italy, people are able to be a bit more picky.
There's like a running joke in Italy that there's this one type of pasta that no Italian will buy, even in a quarantine. The penne liscio, like the long, like penne noodles, you know, that don't have the bumps in it. They hate them. And when I went to the grocery store, it was the only one that was available.
Samantha Slace is an American studying psychology in Brescia, Italy. Samantha has been quarantined for weeks with her roommate, Emmy Palmer, a UK citizen.
I thought it was a joke, honestly.
Yeah, back in week 1, I don't think we really believed how bad it was going to get, and we didn't stock up that much on food.
Now, Emmy said going to the grocery store is a bizarre experience.
They're letting sort of one person in, one person out at a time. Everyone's wearing the masks, obviously, so it's really surreal.
Neighboring Austria is facing a similar reality. Tanya Meyer lives in Vienna and says the grocery store lines are like Christmas crowds times 10.
We talk about social distancing. Like, I think about that trip to the grocery store and I think I was so stupid for going because we were all pushing each other through the aisles.
Tanya has a family of 6 to feed, so she filled her fridge, freezer, pantry, and an extra storage shed outside with enough food for weeks. Tanya used to live in Russia, and friends there tell her that buckwheat, a healthy, hearty grain like quinoa, is selling out in Moscow. Also in Russia, sour cream is nowhere to be found.
They put it on soup, they put it on pancakes, they put it on everything. And so it was really funny for me that in the store here in Vienna, like other stuff was completely sold out, like butter and stuff, but there was plenty of sour cream to be had.
Reports out of Copenhagen say stores there are running out of yeast. Baking is having its heyday around the world right now. Samantha in Italy is taking part.
I've been hand making bread for the last 3 weeks and like cinnamon rolls and everything.
The need to make your own bread and buy weeks of groceries is new and scary for a lot of people. But in Bismarck, North Dakota, Amalia Dillon said people are used to buying in bulk because in winter, it's too cold to leave your house. Amalia began stocking up weeks ago. She said the soup shelves are empty at the store, but the meat section is totally full, thanks to people who hunt in the region.
There are definitely a lot of people here who have chest freezers full of meat. The venison and the antelope and the fish, like, they're not going to be buying meat.
On the other side of the globe, meat is flying off the shelves. Enrique Dubosson lives in the northwest province of South Africa.
It's boltong.
Boltong. It's a dried, cured meat, kind of like beef jerky. And unlike bread, it can be hard to make at home.
Unless you have a cow grazing in your backyard and you have the time to actually make boltong, I don't think anybody will be able to make their own.
People are also filling their carts with groceries that will make them feel better. Sometimes you just need comfort food. For Samantha and Emmy in Italy, that means a little taste of home.
My grandparents are actually sending me a package that weighs 8 kilos, so like 16 pounds of just macaroni and cheese.
My mum put in the mail yesterday 3 boxes full of just chips. And there's a particular British chip that we just can't live without. It's called Monster Munch.
Emmy and Samantha added that the gelateria around the corner from them is offering delivery service, so they're doing okay. Catherine Janssen-Boyd, a consumer psychologist at Angela Ruskin University in Cambridge, England, says seeking out comfort food is normal.
We're buying things that we think is going to help us feel that perhaps the isolation at home is a bit more bearable, whatever it is you have a particular fondness of.
Catherine says in a time of fear and unknowns, people want to feel like they're in control.
You know, you can't control the virus. But what you can do something about is your shopping. You have full control over that. So by stockpiling, you feel like you're taking charge. You're doing something that somehow has meaning when actually, of course, it doesn't make sense.
It doesn't make sense, she says, because leaders around the world have promised their citizens that grocery stores are going to stay open, even in the places most impacted by the coronavirus. Still, there's advice for people who are stocking up. Emmy in Italy says make sure you have enough tea. And in North Dakota, Amalia says remember the basics.
Don't forget seasonings and herbs because you're going to want to mix it up.
Okay, got it. Don't panic. But also, I could really do with that peanut butter right now. For the world, I'm Bianca Hillier.
In the desperate search to treat patients with COVID-19, a variety of medicines are being tested, including drugs used to treat HIV. The hope for success, though, might be overblown, at least in the short term. Stephen Goff is a virologist and a professor of biochemistry at Columbia University Medical Center. I asked him why some scientists think HIV treatments might be useful in combating the outbreak.
There are many similarities of some of the proteins that the viruses encode. So as targets, there's hope, there's expectation, there's evidence that some drugs that work on HIV targets also have some activity against the coronavirus targets. But there's a lot of differences, and a lot of the drugs that were developed for HIV are very, very specific to the HIV proteins, and they will not work against coronaviruses.
So how hopeful are you about going down this path at all?
Only moderately. I think it'll be rare that an HIV drug will be proved to be useful. But in a way, the HIV drugs give you at least a lead into the design of drugs for the coronavirus.
The whole idea that if a drug works for that thing, it could work for this thing. I mean, it's a tantalizing narrative. Are you worried, though, that this kind of hope-filled enthusiasm from politicians and the public for these sorts of treatments is premature?
Yeah. The important thing to me is that the history and the experience that we have with antivirals for HIV, for hep C, for flu, really gives us a huge leg up on finding drugs for the coronaviruses.
Are you seeing a similar response from the public with all the interest in chloroquine that's used to combat malaria in combination with other drugs? That's the same thing that President Trump has touted.
Those drugs have a lot of problems of toxicity, and I think we really don't yet even know they're efficacious. It's not an immediately obvious answer to the problem.
As this crisis unfolds, we've been witnessing some really unprecedented cooperation among scientists in the U.S. and around the world. There's been a sort of fast-tracking of certain types of research. What are the upsides and downsides of accelerating that research?
I basically think it's correct that people are collaborating and working at an unprecedented rate, sharing reagents and sequences and results incredibly quickly. I think it's true across countries. I mean, China and we are sharing results very freely. I think companies are quite open to collaborations. Funding is often being provided by philanthropy, and people appreciate it's a crisis, and they're responding remarkably well.
Stephen, as someone in the forefront in the field of virology, what is your biggest worry as the research goes forward?
Well, it's just a race. It will be a race of when the first really effective treatments come online. And when this crisis of the virus peaks, the biggest concern to me is the hospital overload, which my clinician friends are dealing with, and it's going to be tough.
Yeah, and right there in New York, you're seemingly in the center of it in the United States.
Yep. You know, we're going to run out of beds. We're going to run out of masks. We're going to run out of ventilators. It's going to be difficult.
Where do you find optimism right now?
I am actually really pretty optimistic about good antiviral drugs coming online soon. There are some very potent, effective candidates coming along in many labs. If we can get through the pipeline some of these really promising antivirals and we find a setting where we can get them used early in a patient, I think there's room for tremendous progress there. And I think on the longer scale, in a year or two, I have great optimism about vaccines. I think this will be a virus that will be suitable for vaccines. It's going to take much longer. But I think those will come eventually as well.
Well, it is good to end on a hopeful note, a commodity in short supply these days. Stephen Goff, a virologist and professor of biochemistry at Columbia University Medical Center in New York. Thank you.
Thank you.
Several countries and territories in Asia have gotten praise for flattening the curve of the coronavirus. South Korea, Hong Kong, Taiwan, and Singapore had clear, deliberate strategies to contain it, and slowing the spread prevents healthcare systems from getting overwhelmed. But these places can't celebrate just yet. They're now seeing a new spike in cases of COVID-19. The World's Patrick Gwynn joins us from Bangkok. These countries and territories, Patrick, the progress looks so promising. What happened?
The consensus seems to be that they were doing a lot of things right, but some of these countries and territories let their guard down, right? And so cases started resurging. You know, the whole planet is shutting down now. All these countries are closing their borders. And so you have people from Taiwan, from Hong Kong, from South Korea who want to come home. And some of those people that came home brought the virus back with them. So what all of these countries are doing, they all have slightly different tactics, but what they're all doing now is they're going to double back and aggressively hammer on what was working the first time.
So what did they do at first that worked so well?
Well, the first thing is they're still scarred by past outbreaks. Everyone took it seriously from day one. I spoke to a doctor named Joseph Zhang. He's an infectious diseases expert in Hong Kong. And he told me, hey, we've seen SARS, so if anyone was going to come out and say it was a hoax, that would be ridiculous.
We all in Hong Kong are very panicked so as not to allow the same painful experience to happen again in Hong Kong.
And that painful experience is, of course, SARS. The other thing is, you know, let's be really straight. A huge factor here is universal healthcare. All of these places have it. And I know this is a political live wire in the U.S., but compared to what South Korea has, Hong Kong has, Singapore has, where you can go get yourself checked without worrying about some sort of crushing medical bill. Another huge factor is mass testing. America's rate of testing, the percent of the population being tested, is, last I checked, Marco, lower than Iran and way lower than a country like South Korea or a territory like Hong Kong. So, you know, why is South Korea testing three times as many people as the U.S. when it has a much smaller population, six times smaller? When you know who has it, you can tell where the virus is, who's got it. You can form a coherent containment strategy. And the U.S. at this point just doesn't have the data.
And then there's contact tracing, which has taken place in countries like South Korea. How has that helped?
If you get COVID-19, authorities will start tracing every little detail of your life in a way that's probably more intrusive than most Americans would want to tolerate. But they'll go into your phone, they'll interview you, they'll look at surveillance cameras, they'll try to see if you're lying, and then people in your neighborhood around the country will start getting a text saying, a 40-year-old man got COVID-19, this guy has gone to this bar at this time, people have had their secret affairs exposed because of this. So that is something that's really worked in South Korea.
Is there something Americans can start doing, though, that has worked in, say, Hong Kong?
Yes. So Dr. Zhang, the disease expert in Hong Kong who I talked to, he says, yeah, there's something he's surprised Americans aren't doing, and it's wearing masks in public.
For the Western people, they usually think that only when you are sick, you need to wear masks. But I strongly advise people in the United States to consider wearing masks.
Patrick, experts disagree on the effectiveness of masks, but we know public habits around masks are different across Asia than they are here, right?
Yeah, experts in Asia tend to say it is a good idea to wear masks. I know the CDC and the World Health Organization, they'll say if you're not showing symptoms, don't wear a mask. But in countries like South Korea and places like Taiwan and Hong Kong, everybody wants to have a mask, and the government makes it a priority to make sure you have one. And the logic here is, look, we know that some of the biggest spreaders don't show symptoms. So if everyone will agree to wear a mask in public, just in case, it's seen as a moral duty and a civic duty for society.
So that's the view from East Asian public health officials. The world's Patrick Nguyen in Bangkok, in his apartment, in self-isolation, following those rules. Patrick, thanks for your reporting.
Thanks, Marco.
That everyone is a potential victim, but the good news is that everyone is a potential solution.
Music is finding a way into this pandemic. songs that last 20 seconds to wash your hands to, singing from balconies for moral support. Here's one of my favorite musical dividends of this horrific story. Someone we've had on the show before, Ugandan musician turned activist turned parliamentarian, Bobby Wine. He's back in the studio in Kampala to sing about, yep, you know. The coronavirus is sweeping over mankind. Everybody must be alert. It's a global pandemic we can never take for granted. Ilamutu must be alert. It's a matter of life we can never take for granted. Discipline and personal hygiene, and make sure you regularly wash your hands. Keep a distance from everyone. Report anything like a symptom. Serious fever is a symptom. Dry cough is a symptom. Walk with Tamala is a symptom. Itchy eyes and flu is a symptom. Sensitized to sanitize, Uganda's Bobby Wine there, along with rapper Nubian Lee. You are with the world. As people across the globe are entering self-isolation, what's happening to people who were in lockdown before this crisis? I'm talking about people in prison. Without many resources, medical and otherwise, prisoners are at high risk for contracting COVID-19. Florian Erminger is the executive director of Penal Reform International. I asked him about the factors that put prison populations at risk.
Overcrowding means proximity. So what we hear in the media and what we hear from WHO about social distancing, prisoners cannot usually do that. They cannot keep a distance with others. But it's also a matter of hygiene in prisons in general. Often those are places that are rather dirty, filthy, where you'd have less access to healthcare systems and where you don't really have the opportunity to wash your hands and kind of keep hygienic as recommended right now.
What countries' prison systems are you most worried about in terms of coronavirus spreading?
That is actually a difficult one. In many sub-Saharan African countries, there is a general lack of protection of prisoners whenever they have any kind of disease. So there are big risks there. And then in Latin America, famous for high overcrowding rates and also for prison management often being deficient, a country like the Philippines, which has a 460% rate of overcrowding, that means for 100 beds, you have 460 prisoners. That obviously creates a huge risk. There are also other prisons where you have high security measures, high performing prisons like in the United States of America, where risks might be more associated to security and riots of prisoners because of restriction of contacts with the outside world, with family and relatives, and limitation of movement, no rehabilitation programs anymore. They're in the hands of the state. And so this kind of lockdown of a prison can also create security risks in very well-managed prisons. We have seen that in Italy with riots that actually brought multiple people dead, including prison staff.
So what is the answer for officials? If coronavirus is already found to be in a prison, what is the proper response?
If coronavirus is already in a prison, the affected person needs to be brought into a medical facility and be taken care of there. Potentially affected people need to be isolated in a humane way. What we see around the world happening right now is prisons going in lockdown. And that's extremely dangerous because if you lock down a prison, you create conditions in which the stress is higher within the prison. A lockdown means prison staff stay in just like the prisoners do. And then you have risks of ill treatment and torture that increase. And lockdown also means less access for monitoring bodies, which obviously means in that prison, anything can be happening and we won't know about it. So lockdown in general should really only be an ultimate measure if there is a high rate of infection in the prison. The most efficient way of reducing risks is emergency releases.
Right. So Iran released 70,000 prisoners this month to stop the spread of the coronavirus. You would say that's the right move?
In the case of Iran, the problem is we don't really know whom they released, why they released them. But we also don't really know why they were even detained in the first place. And very often you see that people are detained for very low offenses or non-violent offenses. In general, reducing the prison population is one positive measure. They can reduce the number of people on pretrial. They can release vulnerable groups. In the United States, there's so many people over 60 that sit in prisons, have been sitting for so long. And we should be looking at early release for those populations. When there is a crisis, the prison is really at the losing end. We don't see prisons as an integral part of the society. But right now is a moment when prison management, criminal justice authorities, and governments have to be looking at whom they can release.
Florian Erminger, Executive Director of Penal Reform International, thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much.
If a threat comes your way, you've got two options, fight or flight. Or if you're a certain type of tiny ant, you can roll. These rolling ants are about the size of a sesame seed. Donato Grasso studies ant behavior at the University of Parma in Italy and says these little guys can move.
They may reach the surprising speed of 40 centimeters per second, so it's incredible.
What is the name of this species of rolling ants?
The name is Myrmecina graminicola. They are not rare ants. They are quite widespread in Europe and the Mediterranean area, but it's quite difficult to find them in the field. So we were lucky to see them in the field.
I know you said you were lucky, but I mean, were you intentionally scanning hillsides looking for ants that just came rolling down the hill?
No. It was by chance because we were wandering around in a wood in northern Italy. Mm. We were able to see that the vibrations caused by our movements or eventual harassment by spiders or other ants caused them to curl the body and they suddenly disappear as they were rolling away. We were astonished by this behavior because it was absolutely unusual.
So if this is a kind of defensive mechanism by these ants curling up and rolling away, have you studied how it actually changes the casualty rate because of this ability?
Yes. We put them fighting, ants with other ants, possible competitors in the field, and we measured the rate of casualties, the rate of injuries that they suffered. And when they fought on an horizontal plane, it was some 63% of injuries we recorded. And on the inclined plane, it dropped down to 10%. So this is very effective.
So if this technique, this adaptation is so effective, why aren't other ants following suit?
Probably no many other ants possess this ability because otherwise other people looking for ants, searching for ants would have found. There are some animals, some spiders in the desert that are able to roll away. A caterpillar, some crustacean that roll away, and among vertebrates, only a salamander.
You're in Parma, Donato, where COVID-19 has touched a lot of people. You do this research in the woods, outdoors. I mean, what are you doing now?
Yes, absolutely. We are confined at home, so we can't do anything now.
Do you miss your ants?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. But, you know, we have books, we have internet, we have many, many things to do and to study ants also at home. But, you know, staying outside, going to the field and taste the flavor of nature, the wonder of nature is another thing. But, you know, we will have time to do this in the future.
Wishing you a quick and safe return back to the woods to study those ants. Donato Grasso studies ant behavior at the University of Parma in northern Italy. Donato, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your interest and your call.
And just like Donato's tiny ants, we roll out of here. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.